Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 5th canto, 10th chapter, text 19.
How does that sound? And he bowed himself and said, "What is thy servant that thou should..."
Aham cha yogeshvaram atma tattva. Vidam muninam paramam gurum vai. Brastum pravritta kim aharanam tat. Sakshad darim jnana kalabatirnam. Aham chayogeshvaram atma tattva. Vidam muninam paramam gurum vai. Rastum pravritta kim iharanam tat. Sakshad darim jnana kalabatirnam. Aham chayogeshvaram atma tattva. Vidam muninam paramam gurum vai. Prastum pravritta kim iharanam tat. Sakshad darim jnana kalabatirnam. Aham, I, Cha, and Yoga Ishvaram, the master of all mystic power. Atma Tattva Vidam, of the learned scholars who are aware of the spiritual science. Muninam, of such saintly persons. Paramam, the best. Gurum, the preceptor. Vai, indeed. Prastum, to inquire. Pravrita, engaged. Kim, what? Iha, in this world. Aranam, the most secure shelter. Tat, that which. Sakshad Harim, directly the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Jnanakala Avatirnam, who has descended as the incarnation of complete knowledge in his plenary portion known as Kapiladeva. Translation. And purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada. I consider your good self the most exalted master of mystic power. You know the spiritual science perfectly well. You are the most exalted of all learned sages, and you have descended for the benefit of all human society. You have come to give spiritual knowledge, and you are a direct representative of Kapiladeva, the incarnation of God, and the plenary portion of knowledge. I am therefore asking you, O spiritual master, what is the most secure shelter in this world? Purport. As Krishna confirms in the Bhagavad Gita, Yoginam api sarvesham madgate nantarapmana shradavan bhajate yomam same yuktatamo mataha. Of all yogis, he who abides in me with great faith, worshipping me in transcendental loving service, is most intimately united with me in yoga and is the highest of all. Bhagavad Gita, chapter 6, text 47. Jad Bharat was a perfect yogi. He was formerly the Emperor Bharat Maharaj, and he was now the most exalted personality among learned sages and the master of all mystic powers. Although Jad Bharat was an ordinary living entity, he had inherited all the knowledge given by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Kapiladeva. He could therefore be taken directly as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. As confirmed by Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur in his stanzas to the spiritual master, Sakshad Darit Vain Asamasta Sastra. An exalted personality like Jad Bharat is as good as the Supreme Personality of Godhead because he fully represents the Lord by giving knowledge to others. Jad Bharat is herein accepted as the direct representative of the Supreme Personality of Godhead because he was imparting knowledge on behalf of the Supreme Lord. Therefore, Maharaj Rahugana concluded that it was appropriate to ask him about Atma Tattva, the spiritual science. Tad Diginartam Sagarun Eva Bigachet. This Vedic injunction is also confirmed herein. If anyone is at all interested in knowing the spiritual science, Brahma Gigyasa, he must approach a guru like Jad Bharat. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pastaya Bhutale Shimati Bhakti Vedanta Swaminiti Namane Namaste Saraswati Devi Govardhavani Pacharane Nirvishesha Sunyavadi Paschajadishtarane Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhuna Chananda Shri Advaita Gadadara Shri Vasudevi Govardhavani Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So Maharaj Rahugana is asking a very good question here of Jad Bharat. And at the end of his statement, he says, O spiritual master, what is the most secure shelter in this world? And he's already acknowledging that Jad Bharat is his spiritual master. So he's doing two things that are pretty intelligent here. He's already acknowledging Jad Bharat as a spiritual master, and he's asking him what is the most secure shelter in this world. So he's doing well. Jad Bharat, as we read in the chapter that's the rest of this chapter and the chapter that's coming up, he doesn't let him off the hook so easy. He doesn't answer his question in the very next verse. You know, he chastises him quite a bit before he does that throughout the rest of this chapter and actually throughout the rest of the chapter after that. But finally, at the end of the 11th chapter, we're in the 10th chapter now, he tells him that actually the most secure shelter in this world is service to the spiritual master or to the Supreme Lord. And in the purport, Srila Prabhupada explains that And previous to doing that, he explains to him that his real problem is the mind, the uncontrolled mind, and he talks about the nature of that. So then In the purport, Prabhupada talks about, well, there's two different methods to control the mind. And that's, this is the famous purport where Prabhupada mentions about how one can beat the mind in the morning with a, I'm not sure if it's the broom or the shoe in the morning, and then, you know, 100 times, and then in the evening, the other one, either the broom or the shoe at night. And he says, but there's another method, and that is service to the spiritual master. So that's obviously more practical. And I don't know if that first method is to be really meant to be taken literally anyway. I think it's more like a, you know, facetious type of humor. But the idea is that service to the spiritual master, that's the way to control the mind, which is the enemy. According to Prahlad Maharaj in the seventh canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, I think he's talking to Rani Kasipu, and he points out to him that's really the only enemy of the conditioned soul is the uncontrolled mind. That's the only real enemy. Aside from that, there are no friends, no enemies. So, so point being that for the solution to the problem, you know, Maharaj Rahugan is being instructed here to take shelter of a superior personality. That's really the way we learn or get the solution to all problems. Even in practical life, even in everyday life, if you really, the best method to get the solution to a problem is to take shelter of somebody who knows the solution. Just to give a practical example, about a year and a half ago, I started doing Sankirtan with Parameshwara, and he had some time before the Warped Tour, so he was, for a long time, he's always been telling me, you know, you should do these people, these Latino Hispanic people, they're very sweet, and I was really mean. But, you know, finally he just kind of, okay, let's try it. So he took me to a couple of swap meets here in the L.A. area, and sure enough, it was really nice. You know, the people were very receptive, and I took books easily. And then we decided, they're usually only on the weekends. So, you know, during the week, we were thinking, well, what are we doing during the week? He didn't want to go to the airport. So we thought, well, let's try some neighborhoods where there's like a high concentration of these people. And you know. So we did that, and sure enough, that went well too. But then we didn't know where they were. So I find out, because he's not from here. I'm not from here. I don't know Los Angeles that well. So we asked different people. I think my first guru was Bhagavad Kripa. And he told me about Whittier Boulevard. So then we just decided, okay. We went all the way out to where Whittier Boulevard ended, and we just worked it all the way back into the city. And sure enough, you know, that was, he knew what he was talking about, and it was great. It worked out perfectly. You know, there's just all along that, for miles, all along that particular street, there's all, you know, Latino Hispanic people, and you know, we did Sankirtan there with a team of about four boys, and a lot of books went out. And then after we, how would you say, what's the word? I got all the information I could out of him, you know, and he finally didn't know anymore. Then I had to, Sri Sachi told me about a place, Pico Union, so I went there. And then Mother Gunamai, she told me about this place up in San Fernando Valley, Pacoima. So in this way, and then finally Omkar started doing the program with us, and Omkar is kind of, he's clever in a lot of ways, so he decided, okay, well, let's go on the internet. And he went on the internet and he looked up found some websites that give information about the demographics in Los Angeles and the whole, not just the city, but the whole, you know, Los Angeles County. And we got these websites that told how many, what the percentage was of Latino Hispanic people in any particular little area in Los Angeles, you know, any like township or whatever, how many there were and what percentage of the population they comprised. And we printed those charts out. And then, you know, so I had that for the whole, you know, greater Los Angeles area. And then every day was really simple. You know, I just looked at the chart and I just thought, okay, well, where's the most of them with the highest percentage? And we went there and it was like surefire, you know. So the point being that, you know, just took knowledge from a higher authority. I didn't know. There was a day when I went out just speculating. I couldn't find my charts, and I just went out with Rupa Raghunath, a friend of mine from Australia who was here. And I said, well, San Gabriel, that sounds Latino Hispanic. Let's try that. And it was a disaster. I went there, and it was just all like Korean and Chinese, and you know, it was horrible. So, but whenever I took the knowledge from the higher authority, you know, from the devotees who knew, or the you know, the information from the internet, then it was always successful. So this is a simple example illustrating the point that when you want to know something, you have to the most efficient way to do that is to just ask somebody that knows and then just go with that. Save yourself a lot of time and trouble. There's that expression, don't try to reinvent the wheel. And, you know, the logic there is that there's nothing wrong with the wheel. The wheel's good as it is. It's, you know, works perfectly well. So nothing, there's no need to try to reinvent it, and there's nothing to be gained by reinventing it. And so in the same way, you know, people know things. And rather than just try to start from scratch, we should approach, you know, people. And just as I said, for any, even practical things, approach somebody that knows and just get the knowledge from them. And you know it. And you have that knowledge. And, of course, a couple of points that could be made there. And, well, that's especially, this verse is talking about how Maharaj Rahugana, you know, now he was becoming interested in Atmatattva, the spiritual science. So, you know, what to speak of, even in ordinary affairs, we need a guru. You know, for anything. I mean, if you want to learn how to play the piano, you're going to learn best if you have a good teacher. If you want to learn how to drive a car, you're going to learn best if you go to driver's education, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Everybody gets the idea. So what to speak of something, you know, a very tricky subject like this, Atmatattva, a very confidential subject like Atmatattva, spiritual science. You need a guru. You need a teacher. I mean, I'll just give an example. Just yesterday, I was looking at this book. I drove down to Laguna Beach, and I borrowed Chandrasekhar's car, and he had a book in his car. It was, I can't remember the exact title, but it was something to the effect of Evidence for Survival of Human Personality After Death, something to that effect. So I thought, okay, this is interesting. So I just picked it up, and I was just kind of looked at the table of contents and a little bit. So basically, this fellow was making a point. The whole theme of the book was that there's evidence, you know, that supports that human personality or some part of it or survives after death. And he said there's five categories of evidence. Trudu Karma mentions this in his book and in talks he's given as well. Of course, it's not, you know, which they're reincarnation, you know, children remembering past lives, near-death out-of-body experiences, possession, examples of possession, people seeing apparitions of the dead, and communications from the dead. And what he does in his book is he tries to establish that the evidence for these things is good. It's solid evidence. It's not fraud. It's not, you know, some other way you could kind of dismiss it. And so after, you know, trying to make a strong case to establish that it's good evidence, then he says, well, therefore, from this you can say that you can have a rational belief, a rational conviction that there is, you know, the human personality survives death, even apart from any religious belief. That was a point he made sort of in his conclusions. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And I said, yeah, and I have to agree. You know, based upon what he was presenting there, it seemed like you could, you know, a person could have a rational conviction that, yeah, human personality survives death, even without, you know, being part of any particular religious faith like that. But then the question remains, okay, well, but what is the explanation? Okay, so you come to that conclusion that human personality, or let's say the self, continues even after the body's finished. And you could say you can believe in that, even without being part of any particular religious system of thought. Okay. But what is the way to understand that? What is the origin of the self? You know, what is the nature of the self? You know, so what is the answer to that question? Is everybody just supposed to start from scratch and try to figure it out? Is that, you know, how it works? Say you had a whole planet of people now who just all of a sudden came to the conclusion that yes, the self survives the death experience. But that doesn't stop there. Then what's the answer to the rest of the obvious questions that will come up after that? And does everybody just have to start from scratch? doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense that, you know, human beings have been around for whatever the figure is, so many of them, all over the, you know, the face of the planet Earth, and that one person now, it's all going to be revealed to one person now, just at this point in time, one individual, the whole thing, you know, the truth is going to be revealed. Why should somebody be thinking? You know, you don't realize when you're speculating, but you're actually thinking like that. You know, that if there is, say, an absolute truth of God, a supreme being, he's going to reveal it all to me now for the first time. You know, not anybody else over the past, you know, the millenniums of people that have existed before me and the countless numbers of people. That doesn't make so much sense to me. So anyway, so the point that... that knowledge is already out there. It's just like getting back to this point of don't reinvent the wheel. Rather than try to start from scratch, speculate your head off and try to figure out, what is the absolute truth? Why not approach, try to find somebody who knows and get that knowledge from them? I'm going to read a couple sentences. A book that was written by Sataputta Babu. It's in the introduction, and he's talking about this point here, actually. He's talking about the need for a scientific system of spiritual knowledge. And he makes this point. He says, if such a source exists and is accessible to human beings, well, actually, I have to back up a little bit. He says, if such a system is indeed to provide ultimate standards of personal meaning, then it must make reference to information that relates to persons and is built into the very nature of things. Okay. In other words, the system must have recourse to some universal source of personal direction. Okay, so that's what we're looking for here, with a universal source for personal direction. And is the answer to the questions, what is the self? What is the origin of the self? What is the true nature of the self? Is there anything like it? So he goes on to say, if such a source exists and is accessible to human beings, it stands to reason that other people may have known about it in the past. Indeed, it makes little sense to suppose that a genuine source of absolute personal guidance would remain unknown to human beings throughout history, only to be revealed at the present time. This consideration greatly simplifies the task of finding a genuine spiritual science. Instead of having to invent such a science from scratch, we should search for it among the many philosophical and religious systems of the past and present. Our problem becomes one of recognition rather than one of creation. That's the point I really like. The problem becomes one of recognition rather than one of creation. You don't have to reinvent the wheel, start from scratch and figure it out. You just have to find who has the truth, and then take shelter there. So that's what, that's our process of knowledge, that, we don't try to figure it out for ourselves. We just try to find who really knows, take shelter of them, and then we can know. And that's what we learn from the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says, Tad vidi paripatena paripashnena sevaya upadekshanti te gyanam gyaninas tat vidarshina. Just try to learn the truth by approaching a bona fide spiritual master. Inquire from him submissively and render service. The self-realized soul can impart knowledge unto you because he has seen the truth. So that's the method that's recommended by Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita. If one wants to actually have this atma-tattva, or knowledge of the absolute truth. And then there's a bunch of other factors that kind of figure in there that probably should be mentioned. And these are points that Prabhupada made, that before one is even qualified to take shelter of a bona fide spiritual master, one has to educate himself a bit. And Prabhupada would give the examples of, like, say, somebody wanted to buy a diamond. You have to know. You have to have some knowledge of, what a diamond is and where do you go buy a diamond. Otherwise, you're going to be cheated. And he'd make that same point using giving different examples. So like that, we have to... the person has to have some qualification. He has to know a little bit what he's looking for. Otherwise, you won't find it. You'll be cheated. And also the the person who's giving the knowledge, you know, who's the spiritual master, obviously has to have certain qualifications too. As I said, the disciple has to know what they are. Basically, the qualification of the spiritual master that's described in the Bhagavatam is that he should be Shrotriyam Brahmanishtam. Shrotriyam means that he's conversant in the standard knowledge that's being presented in authoritative revealed scriptures. You know, he knows the Siddhanta. He knows the proper conclusions that are being presented in the Vedic literature well, you know, perfectly. And also Brahmanishtam, which means that he acts, he behaves in accordance with those. And therefore he's Brahmanishtam. He's situated on the level, he's situated, he's actually within spiritual existence. You know, he's fixed, he's actually existentially, he's on the spiritual platform. So it means he's not just talking theoretically when he's describing these things, he's got realization of these conclusions that he's presenting. And Prabhupada would make the point that that's essential for somebody if they want to teach spiritual subject matter. In the purport to that verse, third chapter, Bhagavad Gita, yad yad acharati shrestas tad tad evetarojana sayat pramanam kurute lokas tad anavartate, that whatever a great man does, common men follow in his footsteps. And whatever standard he sets, by exemplary acts, the whole world pursues. Prabhupada refers to Lord Chaitanya's instruction, which is apani achari bhakti shikaimu sabare, that one should, before one teaches, one should practice. Actually, the translation for that verse is, that's a statement by Lord Chaitanya, and he translates, personally practicing devotional service, I shall teach it to all. And Prabhupada refers to that verse in the purport, to that Bhagavad Gita, to his purport to that Bhagavad Gita verse I quoted, and making that point that if somebody's smoking, they can't teach other people to stop smoking. And somebody has to be practicing, they have to be walking the walk and talking the talk before they can be a teacher. And otherwise, it won't have any potency. And he makes that point as well. You know, if you're trying to teach something, you're not practicing yourself, then you don't really know it. You got to know it more than just like an intellectual sense. You have to know it, and that it's, you know, that knowledge is part of you. You know, it's part of your being, so to speak. And then it will, you will, then you can effectively communicate it to others, and it's going to have some potency. It's going to have some impact on their psyche, on their consciousness. So that's an important point, and that's a real important point, actually. And that's such an important point that different mechanisms, even within our own institution, different mechanisms have been put in place to ensure that that kind of thing is there. Like, I'll give an example. Like, I don't know if it's still on the books, but I remember hearing, like, maybe it was 10 years back, 15, some years, so many X number of years back, that the GBC made a resolution that temple leaders, I don't know how far it went. I know it was like people, temple president, and what's up. Anyways, temple leaders were supposed to chant a certain number of their rounds in the temple room during the japa period so that, you know, the rank and file devotees could see that, oh, the leaders are chanting their rounds. See? In other words, that point being that a leader should be exemplary. A leader should be exemplary. That's the point. And that they specifically put that, you know, they passed a resolution to that effect because that's, you know, very important. Leaders should be exemplary. Otherwise, you got no business leading, right? And so, as I said, the leader has to be qualified. The follower has to be qualified, too. But that's a point. And just, once again, not to pinpoint any particular, you know, category of people, but just it's a general principle, just like sannyasis. Prabhupada would make the point, maybe it was in a lecture we heard here just the other day or maybe someplace else, that sannyasi has supposed to have no private life. You know, he's transparent, saintly person, you know, no private life. And that's for that reason, that so people can see that, you know, okay, this person is not just talking the talk, but he's walking the walk, we can see. He's not doing what a materialistic person does with his life, which is going after money and women. You know, so that's why sannyasis have no private life. They're, you know, there's their whole everything is right out on the table there, whatever they're doing. I remember... And even people who aren't devotees can appreciate that point. I'm just giving a little example. I was down in Oceanside, and I was distributing to some Marines. And so right now, I was just trying to get him to take a Bhagavad Gita. But I was interrupted by this Christian evangelist, and he came over. He just took right over, you know. And he started talking to these guys, and he was a very forceful personality. I really couldn't get a word in edgewise. So I was, but at the same time, these guys were standing with the book in the hand, so I couldn't just walk away. So, but he did make one interesting point. You know, in the midst of his tirade there, he pointed out about Billy Graham. You know, he said one thing that Billy Graham did, which I found interesting. He said he always traveled with a companion. You know, he always traveled with a companion. You know. Despite all his other faults, like his claim that he, you know, all things are clean, and he ate the chocolate ants or something. He's famous for that. But he did do that. At least he did that. According to this man, he always traveled with a companion. So why? Because he'd be above suspicion, you know, that he wasn't womanizing when he was out there on his different tours preaching. You know, he wasn't cheating on his wife. He was remaining faithful like that. So that was, you know, interesting. So even in, as I said, even people outside, they have that understanding. You have to, if you're going to be a leader, you got to do it. You got to be exemplary. There's no Papa. In one lecture in Hawaii, said nobody likes a hypocrite. You know, so that's, you know, that's the opposite. And just one more like little reference on this particular point is in that one purport, famous purport where Prabhupada, you know, describes about how Gajendra was in the water and he was, because the crocodile had his leg, and he was out of his element. He couldn't get, anyway, in that purport, Prabhupada says there's no great credit if one takes to the transcendental sannyas ashram prematurely like that. So, you know, making the point that the qualification, the adhikar, has to be there, and that's the real thing. But anyway, now I want to, just going on to the other side of the thing here to balance it out a little bit. Okay, so yeah, definitely, like a spiritual master has to be qualified, but at the same time, and it's not like we should be, you know, have like looking with eagle eyes at our leaders and looking to see, you know, okay, is he doing everything he's supposed to be doing? Is this guy exemplary in every respect? No, you can't have that. If you have that sort of an attitude towards your spiritual master, that's offensive. Maybe that you can have that attitude to a certain extent before you actually accept the person as your spiritual master. But once you accept somebody as your spiritual master, then it's not a healthy attitude to have. You should more have the attitude of, like, there's a statement I can't remember exactly where it comes from, but there's some statement in, I think it's mentioned, the Chaitanya Bhagavat, where even if some devotee is saying, even if I saw Lord Nityananda coming out of a bar, you know, or I don't think it was a brahma, I think it was a bar, still he'd be my worshipful, you know, Lord like that. So in other words, once you somebody is accepted, you know, once you do all that preliminary investigation and examination and you come to the conclusion that, yeah, this person is paka, you know, they know the Siddhanta, and they're Srotiram Brahmanishtam. Then you accept that person as your spiritual master, and then that critical examination should be abandoned, and then you should just, you know, follow that person with great faith, just like that verse, Yasya Deve Parabhaktir Tata Deve Tata Guru Tashayate Katita Kiyotak Prakashanti Manhatmana, that only unto those who have implicit faith in the Lord and the spiritual master all the imports of the Vedic knowledge revealed. So in other words, it becomes a disqualification after you, at some point, if you have, you know, that too much of a, that first mentality that I was describing, you have to accept. And
if you ever need an organ transplant, you'll probably die before you get one. Thousands of Americans die waiting every year.
And one last comment, and then I'll stop, and I'll hopefully we'll get time for one or two questions. Is that even if you do see something or you hear something that's maybe not like completely in keeping with what you might consider ideal behavior, one way I've kind of like dealt with that in my own mind, because I don't know, probably a lot of devotees here have the same thing, but I listen to Prabhupada's lectures all the time. I mean, I have the habit of, when I'm driving out on Sankirtan or driving back, I play a lecture at night, you know, before I'm going to sleep. So I'm here. I'm hearing a lot. I hear the conversations, discussions with other people, with guests, and this and that. And sometimes you hear Prabhupada, maybe he'll do something like, you know, he'll be talking with somebody. Somebody comes in, and I might hear him, you know, like, you know, get say something to somebody, and I think, wow, that was pretty heavy, or whatever. If in my mind I pick up, I feel something like, you know, according to my mundane sensibility, you know, might. And that's the reason why it would appear like that, some discrepancy, then most likely it's not anyway. It's my imperfect perception. But even if it was something that wasn't absolutely, you know, right on target like that, my understanding is this, that Prabhupada in New York in 1976, I think it was, or maybe it was 77, Sura would be able to help me out if I quote it exactly rightly. He was coming down the elevator. He was very ill. And he wasn't in good health. And the devotees were trying to discourage him from continuing his traveling and wanting him to take, you know, to stay there and rest up a bit more like that. But Prabhupada was, he was wanting to just go and continue his preaching tour. So that the devotees were, you know, saying, Prabhupada, there's no need to stay here. You can stay here another few weeks. You got a nice place up on the, you know, on the roof. They set up a nice apartment for him. But Prabhupada at one point got angry. No, look, I can't remember exactly the exact words, but the gist of it is, look, don't leave me alone. I want the benediction that I can, you know, go down, fight, like be a soldier for Krishna, like Arjuna. Just give me that benediction. What was the exact words? Yeah, I want the opportunity to be able to fight for Krishna to the last breath. So that was Prabhupada's mood. You see, so he was a fighter. And when somebody's fighting in a battle, you know, just there's that expression, you might lose the battle, but win the war. You can't expect when you're fighting that you don't get anything. You know, just like there's an expression, if you're fighting with a tiger, you're going to get some scratches. Nobody can expect that they're going to fight with a tiger, even the unless you're Krishna. Okay? You know, the most powerful, ordinary person, you fight with a tiger, you're going to get, at least if the tiger's going to get in a little something there. You might win. But you're not going to go out scratchless or fresh as a daisy like that. So, and like that, Prabhupada was fighting. He had that benediction. He fought for Krishna till the last breath. And, you know, so it's not everything, maybe even if everything wasn't picture perfect, it was perfect in the sense that Prabhupada was perfectly dedicated, surrendered to that, which was, you know, to that vision and that way of serving Krishna. That is perfection. Just like Virabhu in a class he gave, and probably other devotees have brought it up. There was that, and I think I brought it up in a class, in the question and answer period of the class somebody else was giving. There was that conversation. Prabhupada was walking, and one sannyasi, maybe it was Jayadwaita Maharaj, brought up Prabhupada. Sometimes we see the pure devotee, the spiritual master, he doesn't remember a verse, or he quotes it incorrectly, or does that mean he's imperfect? And then Prabhupada made the point, no, you don't understand what the perfection of the spiritual master is. The perfection of the spiritual master is that he is 100%, I mean, once again, this is not exact words, this is the gist of it, that he's totally 100% dedicated, you know, purely without material motivation, dedicated to serving his spiritual master and Krishna. That's the perfection, you know, not that he, maybe, if he doesn't remember a verse or doesn't remember it correctly, you have an incorrect conception of what it is, what the perfection of the pure devotee is, if you're thinking like that. Anyway, I'll end there. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Chandrasekhar, please. In Shreveport, Louisiana, at the
Shreveport Convention Center, 400 Caddo Street. Thank you for your wonderful class, Prabhu. I just have a small comment and a question. When you were speaking about how realization brings the impact, it made me think of two things that illustrate this point. One is recently when Gauravani Prabhu was here, he was speaking to us about his preaching in America with his, or all over the world with his Kindred Spirits band, and he was telling us how when he goes to yoga studios, he'll tell the people, "You are not your body." And these people have heard it hundreds of times. They're in the yoga scene. They've heard it 100 times. But when they hear it from him, a devotee, a practicing Gaudiya Vaishnava, ISKCON devotee, there's an effect. They're like, he was saying that they were like, oh my God, I'm not this body, you know, like a big awakening, even though they've heard it so many times. And similarly, I heard from Bhakti Bringa Govinda Maharaj when he heard Prabhupada personally say, he heard Prabhupada give, the first time he heard Prabhupada personally, Prabhupada told the devotees, please believe me when I say that you are not your body. And the same thing, he says, you know, when I heard Prabhupada say that, it was just like, it was thunderous, it was so profound, you know. Because again, Prabhupada was speaking from the topmost realization. And my small question, Prabhu, is regarding the first point you were making about Avaroha Panta versus Aroha Panta, playing the devil's advocate. I could say, well, you know, you're saying, you know, you're giving your argument that, you know, doesn't it seem silly that for so many thousands of years, the absolute truth hasn't, you know, given any clues or any knowledge of how to perceive the absolute truth, and we have to start from scratch. Hmm? Yeah. But you're assuming in that argument, you're taking it for granted that there is an absolute truth or a God, and as a result, there is a process of descending knowledge that comes to us. But what makes you so sure to begin with that there is such a thing? See, your assumption that there is such a thing gives power to your argument. But I'm not convinced to begin with that there's a God with to speak of a process as descending. So therefore, to start from scratch is the only thing that I think is reasonable.
Well, the thing that comes to my mind is, you know, Prabhupada always gave that example. If you want to know who your father is, you got to ask your mother. I mean, just, you know, you take it back to ordinary learning, and you say that's the way we learn things. You know, if you want to learn something, you get the knowledge from an authority. Otherwise, you never know if you have knowledge or not. And Papa would give that example repeatedly. And he would even elaborate upon it. He said, if you go around asking this man, that man, and, you know, how many men you're going to have to ask. Or even if somebody tells you, I'm your father, how do you know that person's telling the truth? But if you approach your mother, and assuming that your mother's not a cheater, you know, then you got perfect knowledge, very simple. So I think you would take it back to that. But that's the way we learn. We learn by anything, pretty much, you know, that's the best way to learn, just get knowledge from somebody who knows it. So in this category of area of absolute truth, the same thing applies. If you want knowledge of any ordinary thing, you get it from an authority. If you want knowledge about absolute truth, you get it from an authority. Archdeacon.
Bring all those people. Anybody who's at least that advanced to ask, is there really an absolute truth? That's the kind of person we want to speak to. So Prabhupada would say, forget about God. Prabhupada said that many times. Don't even talk about God. Just look at your ordinary existence. You were born. You're alive now. And as you can see, quite clearly, everyone dies. Or you've accepted that. You could go around the world asking, you know, did your father die, you know. But everybody kind of accepts that as an axiomatic truth, that everybody dies. So your first business in life then is forget about studying this science and that science. How can I prevent my death? If you're a really serious person, if you really want to know what's going on, that's the first thing you should try to solve. How can I prevent myself? Is there a way to prevent my death? So if you're actually that serious, then you've come to the right place. And we can convince you that, no, you're going to live beyond this body. But those are the kind of people we want to speak to. Bring them, Chandra. All of them, bring them here.
Anybody else have anything they really want to ask or really want to say? Okay, thank you very much. Gantra Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.